These are the people at the heart of racing. Their lives, their stories, in their own words.
Yeah, racing. I mean, that's where it started, Michael. That's really the beginning. That's where it burned as a kid.
We'll talk about the champion, Black Caviar.
Black Caviar was a freak. So was the trainer.
No, the first Melbourne Cup I was involved with was a horse called Gutum Gutum.
Gutum Gutum.
I was listening to an RSN interview with John Hawkes, and he said, I think it's a really average guineas this year.
This is a very sad story, but making sure that, you know, that his head was upright.
See TJ Smith or Bart Cummings in the background, and you're just in awe.
Follow a lot of sports, but the sport I'll follow most closely will be horse racing.
For the next hour, RSN 927's Racing Pulse presents Racing's Open Mic.
Welcome back to Racing Pulse, and it's time for Racing's Open Mic. A very special guest today, one of the true gentlemen of the turf, who's an icon around the Caulfield Racecourse. Colin Little joins me in the studio. How are you, Cole?
Morning, Michael. I'm well, thank you.
You were just telling me off air that they pretty much built Caulfield around you. You've been there that long.
Well, that's true. I was just saying to Mike off air that I haven't gone far in life. I was born about a 7 iron away from where I am now. So, yeah, I've been there for a long time.
You've had a long, successful career as a trainer. Was racing always your destiny? Were you born into a racing family?
Yes, my father was a jockey. I don't remember him riding, but when jockeys in those days went overseas, they went to Calcutta because the Maharajas would make them substantial offers, and that's where, you know, the reasonable money was. So it's a bit unusual now, but I don't remember him riding. He was badly injured in Calcutta, a bit of a brain injury when you think about brain surgery in Calcutta around about the turn of the war, a bit scary. But anyway, I followed him into racing with the aspiration of being a jockey.
So was your dad a successful jockey then, if he's getting recruited over to ride for a Maharaja?
Well, I don't really know. I can only go by, you know, publicity, old photographs, because I never remember him riding. And by the time I was aware what was going on, he was well retired.
So you wanted to follow in his footsteps. What age did you first make your way into the racing game?
Well, the way it was done in those days, my father made arrangements that I could go over to the famous trainer Ken Hilton at Caulfield and jump on the stable pony and belt round the track. And that was the way you became sort of an apprentice jockey in those days. You just jumped on the pony, totally unsupervised, and probably fell off every day, and rode this little white pony around the track. And, you know, then after I was probably still going to school, probably 13, maybe 14, and that was my introduction.
So what was it like back then for a young kid? As you said, no OCC health and safety. Jump on, do your best.
Well, that's right. You know, they were doing me a favour, really. I don't not even know if it was legal, but I was very young, and possibly it was in those days. But I was only just thinking about being a jockey. I was still well into school years, but that was my start-off experience with racehorses.
Would you say you were a natural?
More likely unnatural.
How much did you have to, how long did you have to work at it to try and become a decent rider, one that was good enough to ride in races?
Well, a few years, probably 2 or 3 years, but there is a bit of a story. Again, in those days, you rode one out in the straight in front of a steward, and then the steward said, yep, you're right to ride in races. And my first ride was 100-to-1 chance at Caulfield, so unheard of these days, a rider not having ridden in a race could get a ride at Caulfield, but that was the way it was done. Anyway, you when you're riding track work, you used to ride with R.M. Williams boots with the big Cuban heels, and the stirrup leather would fit into those heels. But on race day, it's totally different footwear, because you wear little light boots, flat sole, very slippery. And so I sat in the barriers and gave it a kick to get out of the barriers. Next minute, I've got my feet out of the irons. So I went round most of the race without any irons.
At Caulfield, your first ride.
First ride, yes.
So who were you riding against? What era is this?
Oh, look, I only had 6 rides, so it's some time ago. You know, it's 50 years ago or plus, so
yeah, wow.
You know, I didn't have a long career.
Do you remember vividly that first day at Caulfield? Who was in the jockey's room and
no,
what was that
it's
like?
It's all a bit of a blur except the first couple of furlongs when I was trying to get my feet back in the irons.
So six rides, is that all?
That was it, yeah.
Did you ride a winner?
No, never looked like it.
So why did you decide to pull the pin? Were you a realist and said, I don't think I'm any good at this caper?
Well, there may have been a bit of that, but in those days it was 8 stone and you claimed 7 pounds, so you had to ride 7-7. Now, I was unable to do that my first ride of the race. I spent sort of a couple of days in the sweat bars trying to be 7-7, which is probably, what, 48 now, is it?
Yeah, right.
Mm, so they're very light. In those days, but no, the writing was on the wall that I would have a very short career as a jockey.
So how old are you at this stage?
I'm 69.
No, when you hung up the riding boots?
Oh, probably 16, 17.
Okay, and then did you know that you wanted to still be in the racing game and move on to trying to become a trainer?
Oh, well, of course, mother was in my ear that I had to get a trade, so I went into the building game and did an apprenticeship as a carpenter, and I like that. I worked on multi-storey buildings, but in my early 20s, I was granted a trainer's licence, probably with the grand total of one horse. And that went on where I'd train one horse and then it became two before work. So I'd still go to work. And anyway, you're young and single and you don't need money. So, it started off like that. And I was fairly naive. I thought when you get a trainer's licence, you just put a shingle out in the front door and people would come and give you a horse, but it didn't happen. It didn't happen for a long time.
So where did you learn your training skills? Were you working in a stable before you got your own horse? Who were your mentors back in the day?
Probably Jack Godby, really. I spent a lot of time with Jack Godby. He was the trainer before Angus Almanasco, who was then taken over by Peter Moody's right next door. And Jack retired, but I was a bit of a stable groupie, even when I was 12, 13, 14, weekends working around the stable. I just loved it, and I loved mixing with the apprentice jockeys, who were gods in those days, because they were 4 or 5 years older than me. But I spent a lot of time sort of soaking up as much as I could because I was terribly interested.
Mm. So, Jack Godby, how long did you spend with him and what did you learn?
Jack was a man before his time. He was weighing horses, before it was unheard of. He had his own scales and he was well advanced of everyone else, in my opinion, in those days. He sort of had different feeds where everyone fed, you know, just the same basic diet. He'd feed what he called an A feed today, a B feed tomorrow. He'd mix up their diets and he did all sorts of things like that. He mechanised a walking ring and it was a bit like, if you imagine the greyhound training, well, he put a lead on a rail and it and became a walking machine for a horse. So he was a brilliant man.
It must have been a fascinating time back there at Caulfield with the training centre. Would look a hell of a lot different to what it does today. What were your memories of those times at Caulfield?
Well, of course, the great trainers there were, when I was growing up, was Jeff Murphy. Mm. And everyone used to watch Jeff because he was just a genius. And, of course, Angus Almanasco, who was the king of the two-year-olds. But Jeff Murphy could train anything, any horse at all, didn't matter. 1,000-metre flyer, Melbourne Cup winner, Jeff would get it going. Pretty hard man, but if you asked Jeff, he had a very tough, hard demeanour, but if you asked him something, he would be the first to help you.
I was going to say, what was he like? Did you get to know him well, or was it just on a trainer-to-trainer basis?
Well, Jeff used to stand at the gap of a morning, as most trainers did, and, yeah, we all knew Jeffrey really well. He was terribly well-respected, gruff man, never stopped swearing, but it didn't seem to matter whether it was the Queen or the strapper beside him. His demeanour didn't change.
Gee, he had some good horses, didn't he?
He had some fantastic horses. Surround comes to mind, and Gurner's Lane. And we used to watch him at the yearling sales. He'd just, now we pull horses out and inspect them. But Jeff used to just hang over the rail and watch them walk around. And he seemed to be able to pluck a Group 1 horse just by watching it walk past.
Did you watch and learn their training methods as well? Was it, back in the day, was it set up like it is now? You're all in the one hut there at Caulfield and you can see what everyone's doing?
Yeah, it was all. We didn't have a hut. We sort of had a 44-gallon drum and a lump of wood and a fire. But, everyone took notice of Jeff and Angus. But Angus specialised in young horses that really did run quickly. And Jeff... I don't say he was more rounded, but Angus was given a certain breed and he made a great success out of the Star Kingdom breed, where Jeff would put stallions on the map. He'd go to New Zealand and buy a first season sire, and 3 years later he'd be the champion sire, as he did with Sovereign Edition and Sir Tristram.
Yeah. What was Angus like as a bloke?
Well, Angus kept very much to himself. We always thought he was sort of just a couple of rungs above everyone else. He was terribly well respected.
Very astute punter from what we were.
Well, yeah, I understand. He did like a bet, but, his horses were immaculate and, you know, they always used to go out for long picks on the course proper and... he really did look after them, and they looked magnificent.
Of those trainers back in the day, who do you think was the best horse you saw at Caulfield? You would have seen some unbelievable horses in your years there.
Well, probably have to be Surround. Probably Surround was a great horse, great filly, and she could do anything. But we saw some great horses, you know, Biscay, Bletchingly from Angus's, Star of Heaven, went overseas, went to America. He could almost break a 5-furlong record, but I understand they tried to make him a 2,000-metre horse in America. but there were some great horses there.
Colin Little's our special in-studio guest and Racing's Open Mic. We're going to take a short break. On the other side, we're going to talk about Colin's burgeoning training career and when he got his first good horse.
This is RSN 927's Racing Pulse and Open Mic.
Welcome back to Open Mic. Colin Little, our special in-studio guest. The stable's in form, winning races left, right and centre. We'll talk about the current horses in a moment, but we're delving back to where it all began for Colin. Who do you think was your first good horse?
Well, I had a little bit of a think about that this morning. The one that comes to mind is Rani's Palace. I went to Adelaide and plucked this little filly for not much money, I think $2,000 or $3,000, and brought her back home. And she'd had a run at Caulfield, and she was shinsore and she ran last. And may have been a bit of trainer error there, running as a young man, running a horse that was a bit shinsore, or turned out to be shinsore. Anyway, she had a spell and came back and she was flying. So we took her to Adelaide. It was a bit hard to find a race, and in those days it was just incredible. I would have thought there'd be 100 bookmakers in Adelaide. There was two rings. It was a massive bookmaking turnout, Victoria Park, and we thought she could win, and we got a little bit of 33-1.
33-1, wow.
33-1, yeah. And I think she started about threes, and Michael Gauci. There's a bit of another funny story. Michael Gauci rode her, great friend of mine, brother of Darren, and... But he left his gear behind in his haste to get to the racetrack. So it was 1,000 metres down the straight, and we've had, you know, whatever we had on this horse. But his skull cap turned out to be about four sizes too big. So he jumped out of the barriers, and, of course, his skull cap fell down on his nose. So had to stop riding and push it up to see where he's going. And that went on, you know, about six times in the straight in the 1,000-metre race. It was a bit nerve-wracking. But anyway, he was able to somehow win, spending half of the race blind. but anyway, she was a very good filly. Turned out... she was very good to me. She won the first Swettenham Stud Stakes. It was a lot of money. I think it was $100,000. And I was in the ownership, and we sold it to Robert Sangster for around about that money. And to give you an idea, I think I went and bought a house in Malvern. Purchase price was $88,000.
Gee whiz.
So she was, you know, she will long live in my memory.
Oh, God. Are you still at the house?
Yep.
You do?
Yeah.
Oh, that's outstanding. No wonder you love her so much.
I think it's called Ronnie's Palace.
There you go. Outstanding. Speaking of having a punt, do you like a punt back in the day especially?
Look, we sort of run hot and cold on the punt. I find form very difficult. I don't do a lot of form. It's a bit of a black hole for me. I'm sort of into looking after horses, and then when we go to a race, you know, we don't know the opposition. I probably need, you know, in these days, someone that would be helping me with that. I don't have the time to sort of delving into form, and that's, you know, a lot of a trainer. Some trainers are walking encyclopedias on form, but it's a black hole for me.
Back in the day, though, is that how you supplemented yourself?
Well, I think if you have a horse in that class, like if you have a good three-year-old, you know all the other three-year-olds by the time you get to the decent races. Or similarly, if you have a good two-year-old. But I haven't had either of those for some time, unfortunately.
Is that your best punt, that win, do you think?
Probably, yeah. Yeah, it was a, you know, you could get on in those days. A lot of bookmakers, just when I, you know, go to Adelaide now and see three or four bookmakers, it's, you know, just terribly depressing, because I'm not exaggerating, there would have been 100 bookmakers.
Yeah, that's amazing.
And they all wanted to bet you.
I remember when I was a kid growing up, you had a hulking chestnut who was a very good sprinter called Testimony. Was he one of your first really good ones as well?
Yeah, Testimony was a great horse. I used to play a bit of squash, and I met a fella called Noel Stewart, and his sister had been bequeathed a broodmare. And it was quite strange, and they weren't into racing, and met this young bloke that was pretty keen, get his hands on anything that moved, anything that had four legs. And anyway, the broodmare produced a horse, and I was lucky enough, Mrs. Heerman was the lady's name, Joan Heerman, and it was my first Metropolitan winner. So she supplied me with my first Metropolitan winner. Anyway, things went on, and that broodmare had another foal who was a great big chestnut. And Mrs. Heerman was sort of, the bills kept rolling in, and even though the first one had won in town, it probably didn't keep winning, and she needed some help to pay the bills. So I introduced her to who has become a lifetime friend and mentor and client, Rod Fitzroy. Mm. And that horse was called Testimony. And went on and won 13 in town. And they had great fun, Joan Heerman and Rod Fitzroy. Joan was much older than us, but she'd been virtually widowed by the fact that her husband had sustained a bad head injury, and he was just permanently in care. So it gave her a great thrill in life to meet Rod and race this wonderful horse who was able to, you know, win 13 times in town. Not many do that.
Oh, it's a huge record. You speak of Rod Fitzroy, who's been probably your biggest owner throughout your career, and he's still in a lot of your horses. How did you first meet Rod? Was there a story that you used to like to have a game of poker back in the day?
That's right. I met him in a card game.
Underground card game?
Oh, well, it was a bit on the quiet, I think, but... It was actually at Jack Godby's. By then, Jack had retired, and Jack built the squash courts at Caulfield. That's what he did. He bought the old, I think it was a cinema, and he converted it into squash courts. And there was a bit of a little game of cards where maybe a little bit of money used to change hands on a Friday night. And I met Rod, but anyway, they kicked us out. So, you know, we completed the last couple of hands on the bonnet of a Holden in the street.
Well, it certainly turned out to be one of your best games of cards, because former chairman of the VRC, and he, as you said, he's a lifelong friend, and he's been in plenty of your horses as well.
Yes, he's had a bit of a lull for a long time, a bit like myself, and he's had some good horses, but... nothing of note in recent times, except he races a filly called Navaggio, and she's a Flemington winner, but unfortunately, just like the grey horse yesterday, she won't come out of the barriers, so he's not the only horse.
What did you do?
Well, we haven't been able to overcome it. She just all of a sudden was two lengths slow in a race, and I took her to Cranbourne trials, the same as yesterday, just to sharpen her up out of the barrier, she wouldn't come out. She's not frightened. She'll come out with other on her own. She'll ping out, but for whatever reason, she refuses to jump out of the barriers.
Have you ever had that before?
Never. So I was going to ring Johnny Hawks to get some pointers, but yeah. I think he might be ringing me now.
Well, you had Jolan Jolan in the same troll yesterday. What were your thoughts when you saw Chitara
sitting
there?
It's very hard to turn these horses around. You know, no one really can get inside their head and find out what they're going on. Some horses play up, some horses rear up, and there are means of overcoming that. Send them to a specialist where they get their confidence, take a lot of time with them off track, because we don't have the time on track. But there are people that specialise in getting horses that are frightened of the barriers. And they work really well. They get their confidence, spend some time with them, maybe a barrow blanket, maybe earmuffs. But in the case, I think, of Chautauqua, and certainly my horse, she just stands there. She's not frightened. Even when we put a heart rate monitor on her, her heart rate is about 60. Like, she's not even elevated heart rate. But the pink gates ping open, and she's just standing there.
It's amazing. Because you're what's considered a hands-on trainer. You've got a small boutique stable because you don't want to get too big. Is that right? You want to be hands-on with all your horses?
Well, it's a bit the case, but you know, I have a beautiful stable at Caulfield, and we only have 20 boxes and 20 yards, so they're all out there in the sunshine, fresh air, and outside. So 20 is capacity.
Mm. I'm going to have a take a break now. When we come back, I want to talk to you about your Group 1 horses, especially El Segundo, who took out that famous Cox Plate. We'll also have the final field for the Golden Stepper when we come back. You're listening to Racing's Open Mic.
This is RSN 927's Racing Pulse and Open Mic.
Welcome back to Racing Pulse's Open Mic. Colin Little, our special guest. We've got the final field for the 2018 Golden Slipper. The barrier draw to take place at 11 o'clock. Setsuna has decided to go to the Percy Sykes, so that means that Sandbar, who ran such a great race behind Written By on Saturday, gets a run in the Golden Slipper. Written By is number one, to be ridden by Jordan Childs. Santos, number two. Tim Clark, Al Merton, Tommy Berry, and news coming through on Al Merton too. Chris Roots has tweeted that Coolmore has bought a share in that unbeaten colt, Al Merton, which is trained by Jean Dubois, valuing him at $20 million if he can win the slipper on Saturday. Longleaf, to be ridden by Blake Shin, Performer Hugh Bowman, F Troop Jason Collett, Prairie Fire Mark Zara, Sandbar Christian Reith, Enbahar Stephen Baster, Sunlight Luke Curry, Esther Jarb, Brenton Avdallah, Uhud, Zach Purton, Fiesta, Karen McAvoy, Sizzling Bell, Kathy O'Hara for Nick Olive, Seabrook, Damien Oliver, Mick Price, Secret Lady, Benny Mellum for Gary Portelli, looking to go back-to-back in the slipper after She Will Reign's win last year. First Emergency, Kefila, Craig Williams. So Craig Williams doesn't have a ride in the slipper. He's on the First Emergency, Kefila. Gong's Second Emergency, Legend of Condor, and Spin round out the four emergencies. A barrier draw at 11 o'clock today. Cole, have you been keeping an eye on the two-year-olds at this stage? Who would you be with in the slipper?
Well, with the forecast of torrential rain, I think you'd have to go with the Written Tycoon horse. He's won on a heavy 10. You know, the ability, the known ability to handle a heavy track would, as a trainer, would make me very comfortable.
Have you had many good two-year-olds over there? Because you're probably more renowned for horses that get out over a bit of distance and more patient type of horses, a bit like yourself.
I had a good horse a long time ago called Blur. He was obviously a two-year-old. We called him Blur because he went pretty quickly. I just find that the yearling sales, those precocious, well-bred horses by speed size are very hard to buy. They bring a lot of money, and you know, you can line up there and try to buy those horses, just find that you run out of money all the time. So, you know, everyone has to go sideways a little bit at the yearling sales. You can't really buy what you want. So we tend to, you know, try to find something that may get going as a late two-year-old, not so obviously a runner, and would train on as a three-year-old because we want longevity. So that's where I'm coming from.
Tell us where a horse called Palos Verde sits in your love of racing and what she's been able to do for you, because she was a brilliant galloper in her own right, and of course the mum of El Segundo.
Pallas Verdos cost $7,000 in New Zealand, and I couldn't sell her. She was in the stable until she was a three-year-old. She had a couple of immaturity problems, but eventually I found a couple of friends of Rod Fitzroy's who was always trying to help me, Ian Hickey and Don Howe, and they decided to race her, and they were only in her a few weeks, and she won her first start in a maiden, won by six, but she could really stay, this filly, and she's very underrated. She won the Mornington Cup, broke the track record. She won the Hobart Cup, broke the track record. The Mannion Cup in Sydney broke the track record. Admittedly, she had a sort of a idiosyncrasy that she never did well in winter, and consequently I could never get her going in spring. Mm. We'd come out of a Melbourne winter and, you know, she just wasn't there. But when things warmed up post-Christmas, she was awesome. She just loved the heat. I think Mornington Cup was about 42 degrees. Danny Brereton rode her. He said she was just walking around behind the barriers picking grass. She just soaked up the sun. She loved it. So she broke all those track records, but it was, you know, when the tracks were pretty firm.
Is it true you gave away your share in her?
Oh, no, not really. I sold my share to these became very good clients just before she was three. And they're only in her 3 or 4 weeks and she was on her way. She was unraced. But, you know, anyway, it was a good decision in hindsight because they became good clients and great friends.
Well, she might have been great on the track, but she'll be forever remembered for producing El Segundo, who no doubt gave you the career highlight, taking out the Cox Plate.
It's a great race, 500 to go. The sprinters ride on. Wonderful World, Harada Sun, and Devil Moon in the middle. They're followed for the back by El Segundo getting out, and Divine Madonna running on. Then Miss Finland, they turn for home. Wonderful World's got its head in front of Harada Sun, and here comes El Segundo. El Segundo winding up after Wonderful World. El Segundo's gone to Wonderful World, followed by Harada Sun. El Segundo, some unfinished business from last year, he ducked in, but El Segundo wins the Cox Plate by two lengths. Wonderful World, second, Harada Sun third.
What are your memories of that day, 2007, El Segundo getting the Cox Plate?
Yeah, well, a big day for a smallish trainer. Of course, we'd just got beaten the year before. Broadcaster called him the winner, so that was a little disappointing. But anyway, we moved on, and the following year, it was, you know, it actually shut down in the straight. It went into slow motion. I've never experienced anything like it since, but it just shut down. There was a shutter came down and the whole thing was just in slow motion. Maybe that was when he got to the front, and it seemed like about 4 minutes before he got to the winning post. But yeah, it's an eerie feeling, but it was difficult days because it was the year of EI and we're all segregated. You couldn't be near my wife, couldn't be near the owners. So, but anyway, we still came out a Cox Plate winner.
For a lifelong trainer like yourself to win one of the majors, what did that mean to you?
Yeah, well, obviously it's what you aspire to. Sometimes you think you're dreaming and it's not going to happen, but he's a pretty special horse. We knew he was a special horse before he ever raced. The steward came round to inspect him on a trial. We showed him the ID card and he just flippantly said to me, is this horse any good? And I said, this is the best horse I've ever had.
Really?
And he was very good.
So what made you know so soon?
I think just the class. You know, it wasn't like he was burning up the tracks. I think it was just the class that he showed. Nothing was beyond him, and he'd just come home and he'd just tell you that he coped with that really well, bounced back the next day.
Well, he won four Group 1s and CF4, the Underwood, the Yulumba. And I remember, I think the year he won the Yulumba, he was about 6-4 favourite for the Caulfield Cup that year, your home track cup. Things didn't go his way that day. What's your memory of that Caulfield Cup day?
My memory of that day is it was a trainer error. He had 48 kilos and he'd won with about 58 kilos the week before, so he was a handicapping certainty. We could have run in the Cox Plate, but you know, he just seemed so well weighted in the Caulfield Cup. Gouch rode him, and he always got back in his races, and Gouch wanted to go forward. He'd done the form in the race, and he wanted to go forward. And I said, don't think so, Gouch, we'll go back. And he went back on my instructions to probably midfield, and there was a giant of a horse called Lachlan River. He probably weighed 600 kilos on his outside at the half mile, and Gouts tried to get out, and this horse just shunted him back.
Mm.
And Gouts later said that he was wasting too much energy trying to push this other horse out the way, and he never got a run. But it was the trainer's fault. Not
Is that the one that got away?
Yeah, most certainly, yeah. And if I had left it to Gouts, he probably would have won. But I just thought we won't change the pattern. But Gouts knew, and he wanted to go for it. But I told him not to.
He's the best horse you've had, El Segundo. But around the same time, you also had another galloper who basically came from obscurity to win the BMW in Sydney.
Into the straight, and Desert War's got a big lead. He's two or three lengths in front of the three-year-old Gorky Park. Blue Tigeroo is coming right along the rail, and Railings is running on as well. And further back was Confectioner. Desert War's in front, but he's on empty, and Railings raced up on the outside to hit the lead. Blue Tigeroo and Gorky Park, there's four of them across the track. Railings and Blue Tigeroo. Blue Tigeroo's the strongest in the finish, and Blue Tigeroo takes out the BMW, and another brilliant ride from Oliver. Back in behind. And then we had Railings running.
It was a lovely ride from Ollie that day up on the fence. And he was a strange-looking galloper, but, gee, had some ability. When did you think Blue Tigeroo was going to get to Group 1 level?
Never.
Yeah.
I shouldn't say that because the owners... I had El Segundo at the same time, and the owners used to tell me that Blue Tigeroo would beat El Segundo. They had great faith in the horse. And we went to Hobart and... he won the Hobart Cup nicely, but then they started to talk BMWs, and, you know, I had to be convinced, and they had to pay $50,000, and they paid it. It wasn't my suggestion. They paid $50,000 to be in the race, and I had my apprehension, but anyway, they were right. Trainer wrong again. And a great ride from Ollie, and he was, you know, he just kept stepping up, that horse, and he surprised me. I mean, we went to a little restricted race at Warrnambool, and I thought we'd back this horse, and they put him up 6-4, and I thought, oh, you know, he's not a 6-4 chance, but he won by the length of the straight. The bookies knew, and I probably underrated the horse his whole life.
Gee, that's a remarkable period for a small stable to have a horse the calibre of Blue Tigeroo and El Segundo winning Group 1 races at the same time.
Yeah, we were flying for about 5 minutes.
It's a tough caper. Recent times, you've been back in the winner's stall, but it has been quiet. How tough has that period been?
Oh, very, yeah. People know I lost my wife about 8 years ago. Jackie succumbed to a brain tumour, and... it's a very difficult time for us, but I probably lost the ball a bit and lost the plot a little bit for a while. I kept training, but we didn't do anything at the yearling sales for some time, so the numbers got down. But, you know, that's a long time ago. And then, you know, we've sort of just been in the doldrums for whatever reason, couldn't make it work for the last few years. Lack of attitude. We were trying really hard. We just couldn't make it happen. Mm-hmm. And then... just all of a sudden, as we got rid of a very poor year for me, 2017, 2018 just turned the corner.
Yeah. You mentioned your wife, Jackie. I was lucky enough to know, and you live at Lord Lodge, and she was instrumental in turning Lord Lodge around into one of the great bed and breakfasts here in Melbourne as well. It must have been a terribly tough time for you. Did you think about walking away from training when you were going through that tough time after losing Jackie?
I'd get up at 4 o'clock in the morning and do what I had to do, and I'd come back about 7:30 and 8. James would take over before he went to work, and then I'd spend the rest of the day with Jackie. So, you know, I could work because she wouldn't be out of bed, and James was there waiting for her when she got out of bed, so it was a pretty tough time. No, but I didn't wish to give training away, but we did certainly lose the enthusiasm for a while. But she created a great place in Lord Lodge, and the story how Lord Lodge was named, that the previous trainer had been Ken Hilton, and it was Hilton Stable, and then Brian Rolfe took over, and it was Hilton Stable, and then it became Little Stable. And for a bed and breakfast, it needed a better name. And anyway, as a 13, 14-year-old kid riding that pony back then, I was trying to think of the staff were and the jockeys were in awe of this horse. And because I was so young, it sort of washed over me a bit. But I thought about it for a while, and then the name came to me, and he was this great horse called Lord, who I think competed in six Menzies, won four. Phenomenal horse. And so we gave it a better name, and the name is Lord Lodge.
Yeah, and it was a great bed and breakfast when Jackie was running. Your wife was quite remarkable, wasn't she? She was a novelist. She trekked Kokoda. And she also was instrumental in setting up the bed and breakfast. How did you two meet?
I think at a race course. I was saddling a horse up at the races, and a lady introduced me to this stunning young girl, and we took it from there.
Well, it's remarkable. I've got an SMS coming through here saying, can you ask Colin about some of the characters at Caulfield over the years? Skippy Meek, Reg Kent, course manager and father of Mick.
Well, Skippy is the famous clocker at Caulfield. I understand Skippy's still with us. You know, Skippy was four packets of Camel a day and 20 beers, and he was very ill, and he went into hospital, the doctor told him, you know, he'd have to give up the beer and the cigarettes, but he told the doctor, you can have one. He was a character. He was around Caulfield for a long, long time, and everyone loved Skippy. And we haven't seen him for a while, but thankfully I think he's still around.
No doubt about that. I remember Jimmy Meek there back in the day. And I didn't realise that Reg Kent was a course manager and the father of Mick, who was out at Caulfield.
Reg Kent lives opposite me on the other side of Bourne Road. It was a stable where Jeff Murphy first started off. I think it's still a stable. And Reggie was the clerk of the course, and he would have probably led Lord back in. And he was a trainer, but he was also probably more famous as a clerk of the course at Caulfield.
There you go. We're going to take a short break, Colin, then I'm going to ask you about your current stable, which is absolutely flying. Also interested to get your thoughts on who you think's been the best trainer, horse and jockey you've seen in your lifetime.
This is RSN 927's Racing Pulse and Open Mic.
Welcome back to Racing Pulse's Open Mic with Colin Little. Cole, you were saying 2018 has been the year that has turned the corner for your stable. You've had two winners at Flemington in the last couple of weeks. One of those, Big Sir, the little brother of El Segundo, who we were talking about, who was super impressive. It was only a benchmark race, but what potential do you think he's got?
Unfortunately, he sustained a little injury at Flemington, and he's having a little spell at the moment, so it's just recuperating.
Nothing serious?
No, hopefully not. We think we'll get him back maybe for spring, and that might be flying a little high, but he has his mother's attribute, and that is he can stay. He has great lung capacity. He's terribly, terribly backward, immature horse, and obviously four just starting to come good, but we always thought that 2,000 metre plus, because his mother just never ever, what we say, blew, no respiratory embarrassment, could get a long trip, and I'm sure he'll be the case.
Well, that's disappointing to hear he's had a slight injury, but another winner at Flemington last Saturday, no commitment, and gee, it was a great ride from Benny Thompson, the way he was able to push its head down flat on the line. Did you think he'd won on the line?
No. I thought I'd won a Cox Plate, and I was wrong, and I was wrong again. But no, it was a great ride. I didn't think he was going to win when he was between horses, but Ben got him to the outside, and as you've seen in that photo, the horse is flat out, absolutely stretching his neck, and Ben is down right on the horse's neck, pushing him forward. They're fantastic, these jockeys now. Craig Williams, you see that doing... do it week in, week out. They just know where the winning post is, and obviously the only place in the whole race that horse was in front was right on the line.
What do you do with him?
He'll keep going. He might get a little bit more ground, and we set him for that race, and the sale race was a lead up, and you know, we were quietly confident that he might be able to turn the tide, you know, with more pace up up front at Flemington and the longer trip. He's a promising horse. There's another funny story. Look, amazing how horses are. The first run in the race, I think he was probably beaten 30 lengths, and he was probably 20 lengths behind the second last horse. And one of the owners, Natalie Hickey, came to me when I was having his next run, and she said, "Colin, the ambition today is just to get in the picture."
Well, he's certainly done that since. What about today? You've got a runner called Vacillator going around at Ballarat. Nice odds. Do you give it a hope?
He's by a little horse that stands in the South Island of New Zealand. Again, going sideways, looking for cheaper horses with a bit of potential. We were able to... Navaggio, the one that won't come out of the barriers, is a Flemington winner, but she's by Sakinto. And I found this horse last year. It cost $25,000. I just liked him. He's out of an unraced High Chaparral mare. There's not much in the pedigree, but he's still a colt, and he's pleasing us. He didn't go too badly last time. He got back in a 1,000 metre race, bounced off the running rail turning for home, and he probably lost concentration. Be better off over the 1,200 metres today. And I'm just, you know, it's very hard looking at, you know, 90% of the field are unraced, and some of them are written tycoon and runners. But I think he's advantaged by the big straight and the longer distance, and he'll be getting home.
A couple of quick ones to end on. You've had a great association with a number of jockeys over your career. Who's the best jockey you've seen?
Roy Higgins.
Yeah.
Great man. Great. I'd be honoured if I could say that I was friendly with Roy. But I just thought he was one of the nicest people I'd ever met in racing. He would do anything for anyone. He did a lot of charity work, fly interstate. He set up Doxa with Father Jacoby. Great man, and a great rider.
What about best trainer?
Well, Jeff Murphy comes to mind because, you know, Bart Cummings is at Flemington and I'm at Caulfield, so I could only comment on, you know, the trainer that you're standing beside every morning. So Jeff was a great trainer, but I spent some time in America at Santa Anita with a, you know, an icon over there called Charles Whittingham, and, you know, he was, you know, he was just something else.
Mm. And the best horse that you've seen in your time?
Hmm. Well, it's a bit of a off-the-wall one, but I would have thought a horse Tommy Hughes trained called Grand Sidium was one of the best I've ever seen.
Yeah, right.
We didn't see the best of him. He went to Werribee, or he went to a hospital with a problem, and he never came out. So I think he went down as a three-year-old. Unfortunately, he died. And but I potentially thought he was the best I'd ever seen, and it's hard, you know, he didn't go on. But it's, if you ask the question, that's the horse.
Are you a lifer, Cole? You keep training until the end?
Probably. I'm not sure about a lifer, but I bought some yearlings this year, so obviously I'm going on for a while. I bought 4 or 5 yearlings, and they're nice yearlings. I worked really hard, spent 9 days at the Melbourne sale, a week in New Zealand, and we ploughed through a lot of horses trying to do the best we could with the money we have. And I'm not sure if I'll die with my boots on training, but certainly go on for a little bit longer.
Well, it's been magnificent reliving your life and times in racing. Have you got a quick snapshot from when you started all those years ago to today? How much training has changed? And have you moved with the times? Do you use a few more of the scientific edges in your training?
Yeah, we do. I mean, you get left behind if you don't. So we're into heart rate monitors and GPSs and anything we can do to try and keep up with modern technology. Yeah, most certainly. You just get left behind unless you keep up with modern technology. The only thing that I'm probably still doing at the yearling sales, there's been a lot of talk about, you know, how do we evaluate a good horse, and we're still doing it the old way, just simply spending a lot of time and looking at the horse and evaluating them, their They're doing sort of heart rate, heart scans and all sorts of DNA tests. But, you know, I've seen a lot of these means of evaluating a good horse, and I haven't seen one that worked yet.
That's the one. It's the great game.
Yeah, it's probably why racing survives at the end of the day, because if someone could identify the good horse and they had the technology, those people would own all the good horses and all the other people would give up, wouldn't they? So it's probably why racing survives.
Well, hopefully you've got another El Segundo just around the corner. It's been great to have a chat to you, Cole, and it's really good to see that the stable is back going extremely well. Thanks for taking the time to come in and have a chat and talk about your racing life.
Pleasure. Thanks, Michael.
Colin Little joining us on Racing's Open Mic. I hope you've enjoyed the show. Don't forget, Golden Slipper Barrier draw in 1 hour. Nadia will bring you up to date with the barriers as they drop, and we will follow it closely on tomorrow's show. If you're having a punt today, good luck. We'll be back tomorrow at 8:30.